भद्रं खरने पिश्वनुयामते वाह भद्रं पश्ये माक्षभेर्यचत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागुंसस्तनूभिः यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नश्चार्क्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। So we're going to the Katika now after having done Nantaprajna, verse 7 of the Upanishad. There's several verses following that are just an analysis and explication and expansion on the meaning of the Upanishad verses. Okay? So this is verse 10 in the Katika. Anybody have it?
Nivritte sarva dukhanam, nivritte sarva dukhanam, ishanav prabhuravyayaha, ishanav prabhuravyayaha, advaita sarva bhavanam, advaita sarva bhavanam, devasturyo vibhusmritaha, devasturyo vibhusmritaha. Nivrittehe sarva dukhanam ishanaha prabhu avyayaha advaitaha sarva bhavanam devaha turiyaha vibhu smritaha. Nivrittehe. Nivrittehe here means moksha, for the total freedom, the total release. But for the total release, sarva dukhanam, of all dukkhas, right? So you can say regarding the total, for the total release, for the total freedom, being totally free of all of the dukkhas, of all sorrow, of all of the different sorrows. Ishanaha. Ishanaha means the Lord. We'll see what the Lord means in a minute. The Ishanaha, who is Prabhu. Prabhu means the Lord who is, or we can say Ishanaha. Ishanaha is the Lord, and by the Lord they mean Prabhu, the one who has the capacity for the elimination of all dukkha. So Prabhu can mean Lord, Master, but here it means Samartha, the one who is capable of this. Capable of what? Of the elimination of the becoming, of setting, of being free, of releasing one from all dukkha, sarva dukhanam, genitive plural. And that prabhu is avyayaha. Avyayaha means unwavering. The condition that it is the condition that it will remain. So in this sense, because the Atma, because you're the self is free from time, it's not subject to any change. It's free from time means the present condition that it is, the nature that it is now, its swarupa, its swabhava, is not subject to any type of alteration or any type of deviation. So avyayaha means navyeti. It can't go away from its form. E means to go away. Vyeti means to go away from something, to separate from something. And so here, if you say avyayaha, it cannot separate or deviate from what it is. So the Atma, the self, because it's free from time, it's avyaya. It can never change its nature. So the Prabhu, the one who is able, capable, samartaha, for the removal of all of the dukkhas, that one, that Prabhu, is Ishanaha, the Lord. And that Ishanaha, actually, well, I'm going to do the Bhasha a little bit here, so we'll see exactly what Shankara says here. That Ishanaha, that Lord, is Advaita, is non-dual. And how can it be Advaita? We'll look at all these words in a minute, but just to get the sense of it. How can it be Advaita? He says, Sarvabhavanam, for all the beings. He says, Sarvabhavanam, the one who is Advaita, the Advaita, for all of the beings. And in a sense, he's leaving out a little word here that's supplied by the Bhasha. What Shankara says here, he's Advaita for all beings. Why is he Advaita for all beings, Sarvabhavanam? Because he is that which is non-dual for all of the beings. Because all of the beings, all beings that are here, are mitya, like the snake on a rope. That's what Shankara will say. Like the snake on a rope, all of these beings are mitya. And that, in fact, they have to be mitya in order for there to be Advaita. So the Bhagavan, the Turiya Atma, as we'll see, is Advaita because all beings, everything that you experience is mitya. And so this Atma is what? Devaha Turiya. Turiya means the fourth. He's the fourth pada. The fourth pada, the first being the waking state, the dream state, the deep sleep state. Atma is Turiya, is Vibhu, and Smritaha here, Smritaha means is understood, is known as, is known to be these things. So the Turiya, which is Devaha, which is self-evident, self-effulgent, which is consciousness. So the Turiya, the fourth pada, which is Devaha, means luminous, it comes from the root div, to light up. So in this context, what lights up is consciousness. So that fourth pada is Devaha, is consciousness, is Vibhu, is all-pervasive, and is Advaita, is non-dual. Right? And for it to be non-dual, so this one who is the Lord of all beings, how can this non-dual, how can this Turiya be non-dual in relationship to all of the beings? And also, how can this Turiya Atma, which is the Ishanaha, the Pratyagatma, how can it have the capacity to remove all dukkha? Okay. How can it have that capacity? So here in the Bhasha, I'll just go through this a little bit. Shankara says some interesting things. He says, for all dukkha, what does the Gaudapada mean by that? Sarva dukkhanam, for all dukkha. He says the prajna, right? Prajna is the causal condition, the tajasa, and the vishwa, all three of these states, waking, dream, and deep sleep, these states themselves are dukkha. They are the dukkha. You know, it's not that they experience dukkha, they themselves are the dukkha. So he says, I'll explain a little bit more of that in a minute. So he says, Nivrittehe Ishanaha, the one who is the Lord. Lord here, he says, Ishanaha ityasya padasya vyakhyanam prabhu. This word Ishana is being defined by the word prabhu. Prabhu means this Lord is the Lord here because of having the capacity, the capability for removing all of the dukkha. And all of the dukkha is what? The waking state, the dream state, and the deep sleep state. So then he says, this the Prabhu is the one who is capable of eliminating all of this dukkha. And then the question is, Shankara will say, well, how is he capable? And he says, he says, in the removal of this sorrow that can take place because of being nimittatvat,
he says, because of the vijnanam, the knowledge of that being the cause for the elimination of sorrow, the knowledge of the turiya, the knowledge of the atma, of the turiya atma, who is vibhu, who is all pervasive, who is advaita, that is the, that knowledge itself is the removal of the sorrow. So the capacity here, the capacity to remove the sorrow doesn't have to do with any action. It has to do with knowledge, right? Because the very nature of the self is free from sorrow. Your very being is free from sorrow. And also is avyaya, not capable of changing. So if your being itself is, if the atma, the turiya atma, is advaita, is all-pervasive, is non-dual, is all-pervasive, and it itself is ananda, satchit ananda, and is avyaya, means it can't change. So this ananda, this one that is free from sorrow, can't become sorrowful. So the swarupa, so in gaining knowledge of yourself, that is the elimination of all sorrow, right? Because your being is not capable of sorrow. And so when that vijnana, and they use the word vijnana, vijnana means an aparoksha jnanam, as opposed, if we said jnanam and vijnanam, if we put these two words together, jnanam would be like an indirect knowledge, but vijnanam is an experiential knowledge, a recognition of the fact. Rather than an intellectual understanding, it's an actual seeing. So vijnanam is that aparoksha jnanam, that direct, immediate recognition. And so, make sure I get everything. When we say that, when Shankara is saying here that the dukkha, that all of the dukkha is really these states, waking, dream, and deep sleep, what's implied there is not the state itself. The state itself, the waking, say the manifest creation, is actually only Ishvara. But it's your perception of being a waker, your perception of being a deep sleeper, your perception of being the dreamer. Because once you take yourself to be that, through that anyonya adhyasa, once you take yourself to be a limited being like that, you will naturally suffer all of the dukkhas that come from the limitation. Limitation, let me go back here just for a minute. Let's look at the word, what we actually mean by advaita versus dvaita. Advaita, when we say the word, what we mean is non-dual, and non-dual is translated as one without a second. I mean, there is no second thing. If there's no second thing, it's a radical statement, because that means that everything that you perceive is really only the Atma, is only Brahman, is only conscious being. All of this is non-dual. All of this manifest duality is one without a second. And so to understand how that can be, so let's first of all look at what they mean by, they have three ways of understanding the non-dual, and all three have to apply. One is called vijatiya bheda. There's a bheda means duality. There's a vijatiya bheda, which means there are, in this world of duality that we experience, there are many groups. We could say many jatis, many species, many sets. I like, if we use mathematical language, if there are many different sets in this world, it's vijatiya. Within each set, you know, there are different members. That's sajatiya. There's many different sets, like there's rocks and trees and animals, and then among animals there's dogs and cats, etc. So there's many, many different groupings in the creation. So we can divide the whole creation up into jatis. It's called jati. And each jati has many different members. So if you had rocks, say you have granite, there are many different types of granite, many different members in the granite jati, in the granite species, many different members in the cat species. And so you have many, many member, you may have many, many sets, and each set has many members. And then you have to go to each individual member and say each member has many parts. And so this goes on endlessly, this type of a division, you know, from jati to its members to the parts of each member. For there to be non-dual, for something to be non-dual, or if we say this creation is non-dual, what we have to be able to say here is that, first of all, there cannot be many jatis. There can only be one jati. There can only be one. There can only be one, because non-dual means one without a second. So for something to be truly non-dual, there can't be many sets, or many jatis, many species. There can only be one. And then, in that one species, there can't be many members. There can only be one member. And that one member can't have many parts. It can have no parts. And then you have a dvaita. So, you know, when I'm teaching at school, I teach a class called, I'm going to be teaching it in the spring, actually. It's called Non-Dual Perspectives in Spiritual Counseling. And the first thing I ask everybody to do is to write out their definition of non-duality, because it's a buzzword. Yeah. So we can mean a lot of different things when we say the non-dual. We can be talking about how this is just one universe. It's one universe. Right? But that's not what we mean by non-dual, because this one universe has many parts. So you can say, okay, there's just one universe. So there we've got our one jati, our one set. And in that one set, we would have to say this one set has only one member, which is the universe. One set, because the universe is going to include everything that exists within time and space. And so that's only one set. If there's two sets, then two universes means what's in between them. Everything, if you talk about everything that exists within time and space on every level, then we can say, okay, we have this one set that we call the universe that includes everything within duality. And we can say, and this one set has only one member because there is only one universe, if we were to accept that. Okay. But then we would have to say, but this one member is infinitely divisible into infinite interconnected parts, interrelated parts. So some people will call that will be their definition of non-dual, because there's only one universe, and within that one set, the universe, and within that one set, there's the one member of the universe, but this one universe, has interconnected parts, and so that isn't one. That's not one without a second. See what I mean? And so for there really to be a dvaita from a Vedantic perspective, to understand the meaning of the word one without a second, there is no second anywhere on any level. And what that means is that all of this display of duality has no being at all apart from one non-dual consciousness. It is non-dual. This is non-dual in the same way that the pot has a non-dual relationship, a non-relationship actually. Relationship means two. So the relationship between the pot and the clay, is not really a relationship. We call it a relationship, but it's a mitya. It's satyam mitya, where this relationship is a non-relationship, because really there's only clay. There is no nama, there is no form that has any separate existence or being apart from the clay. So here we usually use for a drishtanta, for this understanding of non-dual, is the relationship between wave, ocean, and water. Whereas you can say you have one wave universe that we call Ishwara, one ocean universe, and we call that Ishwara. And this one ocean universe, you know, Ishwara, has many wave jivas. And so that's like the universe with all of its parts. It's one infinite universe
that has many jivas, one infinite ocean that has countless jivas. But the relationship, between the jivas, between the wave jivas and the ocean, is part to the whole. There are many parts that make up that whole ocean. Many waves that put together make up the whole ocean. And the ocean, in fact, is bigger than its parts, right? Because all of the laws that are holding all of these ripples together and all of the ocean together. But you have the waves as part of the ocean, so that the waves could never say, I am the ocean, from the standpoint of being a wave. They can't say that. But from another standpoint, from a deeper standpoint, a more real standpoint, the waves can say, I am the ocean. Because of their recognition that satyam mitya, that in fact the water that is the self, the truth of the ocean, is the same, the very water that is my being. The water which is the being of the ocean, the truth of the ocean, is my being, is my truth, is who I am. And so in fact, all of the waves, all of the froth, and the very shape of the ocean, all of that, that's all nama-rupa. That all has no being at all, zero, zilch, apart from water. The only thing that is really there is water. Right? So whether it's froth, whether it's a big wave, whether it's a little wave, whether it's the whole ocean, the only thing there is water. The waves are mitya, the ocean is mitya, the satyam is the water. So here, all of the jivas are mitya, Ishwara is mitya, all duality, the whole manifestation of duality is mitya. The only thing that is really here is the water conscious being. That is Advaita. And so now, the problem here that we suffer from is that I am, as well as the universe is, this Advaita Turiya, this fourth pada. The fourth pada really is the conscious being that has been being differentiated, the satyam that's being differentiated from all of these states, waking, dream, deep sleep state. The whole teaching methodology is to reveal to me, to make me recognize this satyam-mitya relationship, for me to recognize my being as being what is actually here, which is not subject to change. And here, just to wrap your mind around this a little bit, if we use something like any drishtanta, any illustration, like for instance the wave ocean that I've just used, this illustration, all of them are illustrations. They're not equivalent to the reality, but they point to the nature of reality. So let me show. Here, when you think of water as being the truth of all of the waves, you still have this water over here and this water over here and water 100 miles into China. There's dimension to water. There's space. The water on the right wave is different than the water on the left wave, etc., like that, right? But still only water, you know. But water, the water in the world is taking place within the context of time and space. But now here, it's not quite the same, you know, because here this whole display, waking state, dream state, deep sleep state, the entire display of duality, which includes time and space, that's the trick here. Your experience of duality includes time and space. You know, like for instance, when you dream at night, when you dream, it's not like there are just forms. There's space, air, fire, water, earth. In your dream, there is space, right? There is change, so there is time. There is dimension. So space, time, dimension, objects, change, all of this come within them, belong to the manifestation of the dream. If you have an imagination,
The imagination itself includes space and dimension and objects, and then jivas running around in it, knowing this and knowing that. But all of that, space itself, space and time itself, are part of the fabric of the imagination. Right? So we say also, space and time are part of the fabric of the creation. They're part of the fabric of what is mitya. You know? What is mitya? What is objectifiable? What is subject to change? Which has for its vastu, or its reality, conscious being, which is me. Okay. Now that puts us in an interesting situation here. Because the me, the conscious being that you are, this me, this what makes you you, has nothing to do with time or space or dimension. It's not big or small. It doesn't have a right side or a left side or an up or down. And it doesn't, because if you get rid of time and space, if you get rid of the time and space of the creation, then your being is simply all that is. And so there's nothing to demarcate it. It's one homogeneous conscious being. And there is nothing else. There's no space, there's no time. There just is simply me, the conscious being. What this means, and you have to kind of work with this in understanding dream, understanding imagination, seeing how dimension, the extension and dimension are something that are part of your imagination, for instance, in your imagination. And to recognize, just playing with your imagination, to recognize what happens to you, to your being, when an imagination comes. Like, for instance, if I imagine a room, or if I imagine a meadow, or I imagine the solar system. Just bring that three-dimensional, imaginations are three-dimensional, they're not flat, right? And so now you have time and space imagination, which is taking place in your being, which is free of time and space. Right? And there's no place, there's in your imagination, there is no part of that three-dimensional imagination which is away from you. And so a three-dimensional imagination or a three-dimensional dream has the non-dimensional one, who is not subject to time or space, as its self. Do you understand what I'm saying? You can understand just by playing with your own mind and your imagination and recognizing the fact of it and recognizing experientially what that means. To recognize what we mean by juxtaposing your own meanness, your own presence, doing a viveka, discriminating your presence in reference to or from the three-dimensional imagination. You know, your presence, which has nothing to do with dimension, is the self of the imagination. The self, the presence, your being, having nothing to do with dimension or space, because that comes with the imagination, that means that there is no distance between me and you. If you're a wave, and 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 I'm a wave, we're all water, but there's distance between us. There's distance between this water and this water, this clump of water and this clump of water, right? Because water exists within this three-dimensional universe. And that's why the drishtanta, the illustration, is limited, because the water takes the same expanse as the ocean, as the waves. It's the same size. Whereas you aren't a size. You have nothing to do with size. You're not a size. You're not a color. You're not subject to time. You're not big. You're not small. These words don't apply. And what makes this very interesting is that, in fact, that the fact of that, in a way, helps you to differentiate your being from this mitya magical expanse. I say magical expanse because if you think of the fact that you can have an imagination or a dream, that is amazing. That is very magical. We just take it for granted. You know, but actually that you have that maya. You have where Ishvara has the maya, the infinite, in infinite proportion total. You have it in what we call Ulpa. Ulpa, just a little touch of it. It's the same maya, though. But subjectively, that you can have a three-dimensional imagination, that you can have a dream, that you can actually project a snake on a rope, that you have this capacity, this is maya. And so this maya, whether it's subjective or whether it's objective, it is only subjective and objective from the standpoint of each other. Like I would say, this is objective. This maya is objective. It's not subjective because it's not being projected by me. But that doesn't make it any different. From the standpoint of Ishvara, it's subjective. It's just, it's Ishvara. You know, it's Ishvara's maya. So you get to recognize what maya is like for Ishvara by looking at your limited maya, because your limited capacity does exactly the same thing, but it's subjective and limited in this sense. That when I have an imagination, it's a three-dimensional imagination, which is taking place in my limited buddhi, my little piece of maya here. And so you are not experiencing it. There's no shared reality. It's what we call pratibhasika. It's subjective reality. Right? So, but it is still maya. It's still this capacity. But we just say, oh, that's imagination. But you're forgetting what it is, what this imagination is made of. This imagination is made of maya. Now say it's my little imagination, my little three-dimensional imagination, which enjoys my being completely. In my little imagination, there is shared reality among the members within the imagination. Right? They're all talking and doing this and that with each other, and they have a shared reality. And I'm Ishvara for them. Right? And I have this imagination. There's all this stuff going on. Say there's little people walking around in the imagination. I'm their Ishvara. You know, and they can have their little subjective imaginations, you know, and they'll say, oh, this is just my imagination. But they're using the same maya. It's the same infinite capacity, you know. So now, say you pull back, get away for the moment, just recognize your subjective imagination as maya. Now look at this whole infinite universe as maya. And now here, we are part of that maya, we are waves in the ocean, part of that shared reality. Right? We're sharing this, we're all within the bubble of maya, and we have our relationships and whatnot. But the self that is the self of your subjective imagination, this me, has no time, has no space, has no borders, because there is no second thing. So this me that you are, which you experience as your being, not as an object, but as the self-evident me, this me that I am in my little imagination, right, is the me that I am in the infinite imagination, because there is only one me, and that me has nothing to do with time and space, it's not big or small, and so consciousness is consciousness. It's not big consciousness, it's not little consciousness, it's the me that you are is the me that it is. That is. You can't say, Ishvara has a big me. The ocean has a big me, it's enjoying all the water. Right? Right. The ocean is enjoying all the water, I as a jiva, I only enjoy a little bit of the water. That's the problem with the illustration. Because here, consciousness has no dimension. Dimension belongs to this order of reality. Right? And so then when you think of water, water is still has dimension. Conscious being has no dimension. Conscious being is one without a second.
There's no second thing for it to have a right side or a left side. So then, that being the case, what is the relationship between conscious being and this infinite projection? If the infinite projection of the creation had any being of its own, then there would be some prakriti that we say is some matter, and there's some purusha stuck on it, some like Sankhya, some conscious being stuck on it. But here the relationship between satyam, the conscious being, and the projection of the entire universe is very much like the relationship between conscious being and your subjective projection. When you think about it like that, what is the relationship between your dream or your imagination and you? That's why, just taking it from the standpoint of the jiva, between your subjective imagination, when the imagination can say like this, the imagination comes from you, is sustained by you, and goes back into you. But nothing happens to you during this process. That's why we say conscious being is avyaya. It never loses its own nature. We say it is advaita. It is non-dual. Why? Because everything in the projection is mitya. Sarva bhava nam mitya. For all these beings that come from your imagination, none of them have an independent reality. The reality they have is like the snake on the rope or the pot on the clay. There's no independent reality for it to have a second existence to make there be dvaita, to make there be duality. And so if you can recognize what we mean by non-dual in reference to your consciousness, the conscious me that you are, and your imagination, you can see how that is non-dual, then you understand exactly, really, how this creation is non-dual. Because this display of name and form has no substance whatsoever apart from me, and my being is pervasive. But from the standpoint of the projection, whether it be subjective or objective, my being is pervasive to it. There is the, let's put it like this. When I have a subjective projection or that imagination is. And everything in it, the whole imagination is, and everything within it is. Right? But when I withdraw the projection or the imagination, the isness is still there, but the imagination is gone. When you wake up from a dream, it's the same incredible experience. When the dream is there, it is. It has internally its own order, its own reality. But when you wake up from the dream and the dream disappears, the sat-chit is there. Nothing happens to it. Nothing happens to what is actually there. But the dream manifestation goes away. So because the dream or the imagination, or in this universe, all us being part of it, all of the nama-rupas, all of the names and forms that we experience are coming into being and going out of being. Right? But when you think of this language, even in why do we talk like this, it comes into being, it goes out of being. When you say that it's coming into being, going out of being, being remains. And being is the satyam. The being, though, doesn't have a right side or a left side. It doesn't have a top or a bottom. It has no dimension. It is the self of everything. It is equally the self of me. It's equally the self, the same me, is the self of whatever is in this room. And it's also the self of what's in any other dimension of within duality. Because there's no
if you think about the relationship between, I like this, if you think of the relationship between your being and your imagination, okay, it does not matter how big the imagination is. You can have a huge imagination, or you can have a tiny one. You can have imagination that goes all over solar systems. It is absolutely irrelevant. It doesn't make any difference. However big the imagination is, you are pervasive of that imagination from the standpoint of the imagination, because there is nothing outside of you. It's not like you're bordered by non-existence. Then you, that's dvaita. Here's you, conscious being, and on the edges of conscious being, there is non-existence. But there are no edges, because there's no second thing. And another thing for that, non-existence doesn't exist for it to bind you or for it to give you a shape. So if you say, well, there is existence, but existence is bordered by non-existence, well, non-existence doesn't exist. It's not there for you to even think like that. And so now what we have are all of these things, all of which exist. There is nothing ever in your experience that does not exist. Even the imagination of non-existence, that imagination is. You cannot get beyond existence. However, you never get beyond existence, but you also can't look at existence. You can look at all of the nama-rupas with the nama-rupas are looking at nama-rupas. But you can't look at existence because you are existence. And existence has no form, it has no duality, it is simply, it has no space, it has no time, all of that comes within this projection. And everywhere the projection is, I am, but I'm not spread out like water. I myself am free of time. And so this is free of space. So this is actually something that you can recognize even in this room right now with your eyes open. If you can recognize just your own presence, that this me that you are, what makes you you, and then not thinking about it in terms of the body or the mind or the sense organs, but just your presence, you just ask, you know, how big am I? What size am I? What color am I? How tall am I? These words are meaningless. When you're sitting in contemplation and just abiding with yourself, you can ask, okay, how big am I? What is my dimension? You know, these words are just fall away because they're absolutely irrelevant to your nature, and that becomes aproksha. That becomes self-evident as you do this type of discernment. But it's very important, you know, to understand this satya mitya, exactly what we mean by mitya. Mitya means that it has the being that this creation is enjoying, you know, doesn't belong to it, in a sense. It is the only thing that's there. It's not that the nama-rupas that you experience have a being of their own. The being that they enjoy is a non-dual being which can't be projected, but is itself self-evident. I'm the bottom line. I am, my being is self-evident. It can never not be known. It doesn't require a pramana to be known. It doesn't require a thought form. It doesn't matter if my mind is awake or asleep. My being is self-effulgent, and it's not doing anything at all. So this is something that has to be discerned. So this Atma that is the truth of everything, that is free. This is what is free. This is moksha. This self is moksha. It is liberated by its very nature. So now, in this verse, what's being said is, this Atma is Ishanaha. This Atma is the Lord who is Prabhu, means who has the capacity. It's this very Turiya Atma, which is, we call it the fourth pada, in reference to the waking state, the dream state, the deep sleep state. This Atma is called the fourth pada, the fourth state. But actually, it's not the same. Here's the waking state over here, the dream state over here,
and the deep sleep state over here, and over here's the fourth state, the Atma. That's not what it is. It's the fourth state is the recognition of the Satyam, that which is the very self of the waking state, the dream state, and the deep sleep state. Now, that Turiya Atma is the one and the only one who has the capacity to get rid of all dukkha. And the reason that it can do that is because that is its very nature. It is its nature. That freedom from dukkha is its nature. And so it's through the vijnana, it's through the knowledge of that, that all of that dukkha, the recognition of that, that all of the dukkha is removed. So now to understand that, waking state, dream state, deep sleep state, all involve my identification with mitya, the identification of me, the non-dual, non-dimensional, changeless, whole presence of my being is taken by this waking state, the jiva within the waking state, to belong to it. And so the waker, the body, mind, sense organs here, because of ajnanam, because of ignorance, says, I am, you know, it says, I, this body, mind, sense organs, I am the Atma. I am the self. Now, as soon as I say that, there's dukkha. Because this body, mind, sense organs is subject to birth and death and change. And it's subject to limitation. And so there's endless dukkhas that come from that. All of the projections on the mind. Same with the dream state, subject to dukkha. Because limitation, birth and death limitation. The deep sleep state is also said in this verse. It's also dukkha. It's not subject to dukkha, it's dukkha. The whole thing is dukkha. And then you say, well, why is the deep sleep state dukkha? Why is it sorrow? You know? Because nothing's happening there. Everything's in unmanifest condition. It's fine. It's, you know, total ignorance is bliss. No problem. No. It's dukkha because it is the bija. It is the cause for the projection of the waking state and the dream state. The causal condition of the waking state and the dream state is the deep sleep state. Now, he doesn't go into this here until the next verse. In the waking state, let's do a little bit of this and we'll do it next week in the next verse. In the deep sleep state, in reference to the nature of yourself, of your being, from the standpoint of the deep sleep state, there's just total ignorance. There's no comment on it. It's just total ignorance. There's no projection. Just ajnanam. It's a big I don't know. We'll see in the next verse, a big I don't know anything. Without even the words. So it's considered, you know, the agrahanam. There's atma agrahanam. There's no recognition of what is. But that agrahanam is what is responsible for the ajnanam in the waking state and the deep sleep, in the waking state and the dream state, which are projections from that maya. So projections, I've got to do this next week because it's a big unfoldment. It itself, the waking state and the dream state, come from that total ajnanam that allows you to say, I am the waker and I am the dreamer. Okay? The causal condition for that is what is experienced in the deep sleep state. And so it's considered to be just dukkha also, because it's responsible for all the problems that are in the waking state and the dream state. And so it itself is considered dukkha. So waking state, dream state, deep sleep state are all dukkha because you become a limited being in those states. And as a limited being, you're subject to birth and death and ananda. Your wholeness is away from you. And so it's considered to be nothing but dukkha. The Atma is considered the Lord because of its absolute capacity to destroy, because the jnanam, big jnanam of that self, destroys all of the dukkha. The dukkha itself the dukkha itself is brought about, is caused by self-ignorance. If there once knowledge is there, everything that you had projected, you'd projected your being, this body, mind, sense organs, had projected that wholeness onto the world and the running after it, has projected your existence onto what is finite and subject to death. You've projected knowledge in its pure form, just as manifest consciousness. Consciousness is knowledge. What do we mean by that? Consciousness as knowledge is the experience in the world that in the world that I am aware of. It's experienced as known. And so I collect knowledge. You know, I'm collecting knownness in my identification of knownness with objects. So this is known, and now this is known, and then this is known, and now this is known. I don't recognize that the very swarupa of knownness is the Atma. Right? This is known, this is known, this is known, the body is known, the sense organs are known, the mind is known, this textbook is known, all of us languages are known, everything is known, 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 known. And so the more intricate knownness I'm carrying around with me, the more intelligent I am. You know, I collect knownness and then I have them all interrelated with each other. But the knownness, in fact, that, you know, that I'm seeking is the infinite non-dual knownness of my own svarupa. That's a very interesting thing. I'm not against collecting all kinds of knowledge, but you have to, it's different when you recognize what you're actually seeking is the very nature of your own being, the very self-evident nature of your being. And so here, it's in the removal of self-ignorance that this dukkha is destroyed, not because anything is done. Right? It's because it's a recognition of what already is. And the Atma has that, Prabhu is the Lord of that, because the Atma is the one who is that. The Atma is the one that is free of dukkha. And in fact, nothing else is free of dukkha. Everything else is mitya. And when you're trying to find the ananda that you seek in the mitya, that's, and there is no mitya. It's like saying, if you, in an absolute way, it's like saying there is no pot because there's only clay. But what if I'm searching for my wholeness in the namarupa? So it's almost as though you're searching for the satchit ananda of your being in something that is not really even there. It's an amazing thing to, it's an amazing illusion to really understand that. You know, just think of the problem. Like sometimes we use this example, if you take a big block of clay, you have a bas-relief complex kind of scenery carved out of this bas-relief clay, and you see all of these individuals engaged in all kinds of activity with each other. And of course they're using their sense organs and their karmendriyas, you know, their organs of action and their five sense organs. They're using their mind, right, to do all of this. But all of them, the sense organs and the mind, the karmendriya, the organs of action, all of it can only relate to the mitya, to the other namarupas. None of it is relating to the clay, right? They're only relating to the namarupas, the names and forms, which are not really there. I mean, they're there, but what is really there, the only thing that is really there is conscious being. And so it's almost as though that's the amazing thing of Maya. It's not that this isn't here, it's here. But really the only thing that is here is consciousness. And it's as though we're looking in the opposite direction, trying to find, we're searching for ourselves, looking in the opposite direction. You know? But just think about it, like in the very intricate scene, in a bas relief,
They're only capable of seeing the nama rupa, not as what is actually there. And what is actually there, they already are. Is the one whole being. That's why Swamiji, right after Ramana died, Swamiji, you know, went to the ashram there, and unfortunately he didn't make it in time to meet with Ramana, but he met with one of his disciples, and Swamiji asked the Swami in his own right, who was giving satsang, you know, how can I find that shanti? He's a young man. How can I find that shanti peace? What can I do for that? You know, to get that. You know. And the old man said, that's just the problem. You can't do, don't do anything. Just stop the doing. Stop the doing. You know. And if you notice for yourself, we don't even notice these things. So many things that are so profound, we don't really notice. But you know, when your mind is not active, if it's not worried, it's not engaged in all of these things, if you just are quiet. Mm-hmm. You know, just be quiet for a minute. And you know what? You're fine. Everything is fine. All you really have to do is just pull your mind. Your mind's just creating, going wild, you know, in this maya, just getting all tangled up in it. All tangled up in nothing. Then nothing's really there. It's all tangled up in it, you know. And then you just have to say, you're all tangled up in something that is not really even here. Just relax. Relax. Of course it's here, but it's not here in a way. In terms of the pot being here, there's really only clay. In terms of all of the waves being there, it's really only water. In terms of this creation being here, when you wake up from a dream at night, you know, you wake up from a dream, what do you recognize? Nothing has happened. So much has happened, absolutely nothing has happened. And I haven't lost anything either. It's not like the dream goes away and something has happened. Because what is the dream? The very being of the dream, the very self of the dream, what is actually there is me, and there's not one thing has happened to me. You know, and that's recognized at the time when you wake up. You know? That's an amazing thing. What you recognize and can recognize at the time, like when you wake up from a dream, what you recognize if you play with your imagination, the relationship between you and the imagination, what you recognize between your relationship with your thoughts, that's satyamitya. The relationship with your thought or with your dream or your imagination is really not any different than your relationship with this world. Yeah. That's something to play with, but let me tell you why, just so that you can, when you're walking around, you can think about this. If I have an imagination right now, say I think of a meadow, for instance, my mind has a vritti, a thought modification, of whatever that imagination is. Let's ask you to think of a meadow, okay, I have a thought modification of a meadow. That meadow comes in me, is sustained by me, I'm the self of that meadow. And then I change the thought to, say, a beach. The meadow is gone and now I have the beach, okay? The beach has come, it's sustained by me, resolved into being, I'm the self of the beach. Now I say, open your eyes and have a thought modification of this room. Okay, now I've opened my eyes, I'm looking at the room, I have a thought modification of the room. Now the thought modification is given to me through my perception, through my eyes, but my experience is the thought modification of the room. In imagination, my experience is the thought modification of the imagination. In either case, it's a thought modification which comes from me, is sustained by me, and resolves into me. And so, even though I also recognize that in terms of thought modifications that are generated by my perception, I realize that, oh, I'm a body, mind, sense organs within this Ishwara, right? I realize that. But you should know that that's another issue, and we are dealing with that issue also. But you should know that in terms of your experience, the pervasiveness that you have and recognize in reference to the meadow thought is not at all different than in reference to the room thought. Because in any case, either case, it's a three-dimensional vritti which you are aware of. Right? So what is the relationship of conscious being of me to whatever thought modification is there? The reason you have this thought modification is because of your sense organs, but still, it's a thought modification. It's a vritti. Vritti, vritti, vritti. Imagination vritti, memory vritti, perceptual vritti, you know, dream vrittis. So if you can so easily recognize the mityatva of a meadow imagination and recognize the pervasion of yourself from the standpoint of the imagination, recognize the freedom and the changelessness of your being from the standpoint of the imagination. If you can do that, then do that for a while and then open your eyes and do it with this. Because it's not any different. Imagination or a vritti generated by perception is not any different at all in terms of the pervasiveness, the non-dual nature, the changeless avyaya, the changeless nature of my being. And so what has to happen with knowledge, this is the viveka, this is viveka. This is how I recognize me, the one who is actually avyaya, never subject to any change at all, and full and complete by my nature. I am, in fact, all that is. Because I'm what, I'm the sat, I'm the one that is always here. I never go anywhere. I'm not subject to any time. All this time, past, present, future, perception after perception after perception, is all taking place in me. I'm not going anywhere. And so, one great thing about meditation, just relax. Let everything be quiet. Accept your mind as it is. Just let it all be. And notice who you are. You're fine. You're absolutely fine. What happens is the mind starts to recognize the fact of it and starts to stay home more, to just enjoy your own presence, and let maya, let the mitya be mitya. Let it be Ishwara. It is Ishwara. Just think of the what it would be like. Say you are having a very complex imagination and it's going on and on and on. And those characters in the imagination, one of them becomes a mumukshu and looks for a guru in that imagination, and then recognizes the truth of the whole thing. You know? The truth of the whole thing is all of the little jivas in that imagination are part of a much bigger story. And the self of all of the little jivas in the imagination is the very me of the whole imagination. But they're just playing a very limited, I mean, bound. They're, the jivas in the imagination are very bound by the force of Ishwara, of the total story. Right? They're part and parcel and caught in the tremendous power, the shakti of the of the whole story. And so a jnani little jiva in the imagination will appreciate the infinite being part of that much bigger story and let that story take place, recognizing, having done viveka, you know, on the truth of the self that they are. There's only one self. The self of the jiva in the imaginations is the self of the Ishwara of the imagination. So you can actually, it's very helpful to play with this because you can see the dilemma and what it would mean, you know, for the little characters, any little characters to have knowledge, how that would change things. It changes things dramatically because each character, for a jnani, is the recognition, you know, of who I am in the total of the whole mitya. I am the very self of the mitya. And you also understand the psychodynamics around ananda, that each of these are like banging your head against the wall, you know, trying to find your fullness in the mithya. So, well, he goes on with this, so it'll be very nice. Let's see. Let's take a moment. Dachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om. Did he came to class today?
Why is it so hard to see that, you know, the creation is Ishvara's projection, where it's easy to see your own imagination as a projection?
Well, because you have an imagination, so it's obvious, mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah, that's easy.
It's easy. But when you're a member within the projection, then all of your sense organs, your mind, your karmendriyas, organs of action, all of that, are all meant to only participate within the projection. Right?
Yeah.
And so it takes really quite a bit of a viveka to even ask the question, it's kind of like a what is really going on here type of question. What is the reality of, is there some underlying reality? You know, and then the identification of the body, mind, sense organs with the satyam, which is like the pot's identification with the clay. I mean, how could the pot is the clay. How could it not be identified with clay? See, this is the dilemma. In the clay pot, the pot is the clay. It's correct. It's not anything else. It actually is the clay. You or your body, mind, sense organs actually is such chit. Just like the rug, but the rug doesn't have a sukshma sharira, a subtle body to say anything about it. Mm-hmm. Right? But this maya, this says something about it. You know, it says, I am the conscious being. Absolutely true. But it doesn't recognize it from the other way around, that the conscious being that I am is totally free of this. Mm-hmm. Or do you say it in a different way? The conscious being that I am is the self of this, as well as everything else. Right? So that's the satyam mitya. The mind doesn't know that. It says, I am that. And then it also says, and I am happy and sad and depressed, and I have no control over myself. It also says, I am the body, and I am subject to birth and death. That's all, see, it's all dukkha. That's what we consider dukkha. You know, because nothing really has a happy ending.
And the truth is counterintuitive to the mind, because the mind, just even when it hears that, it will say, yeah, that's not true.
It won't say, it'll say that in a sense, everything, all of your relationships and interactions are within duality, because the sense organs and body and karmendriyas are only meant to respond here. You know, but when it's pointed out, there's mm-hmm. such a freedom. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like the mind totally resists.
No.
Because when you hear it, it rings true. You know, there are certain things to understand, like, yeah. I am, and that never changes. All of these experiences that are negating each other, I'm always there. Waking, dream, deep sleep, negate each other, I'm always there. That's a fact. And when it's pointed out, I can start differentiating me, the one who's always there, from these experiences the mind it's so identified with.
So that's the Prabhu then.
Prabhu is the Atma, because the Atma is the one who is capable of this, giving this freedom, because it is that freedom. Yeah, that's its samartya. It's not giving a freedom through doing. It's giving a freedom through being. So it's the very vijnanam, the very recognition of that is the freedom. We say the Atma gives that freedom, has the capacity of giving that freedom, not through an action, but through the recognition of it.
You know, what's interesting is that I think you unfolded that so beautifully, I mean, so clear. I mean, it seems like that's a topic every time, but, right, from a different, slightly different angle. We just change the angles, but there are millions.
That's exactly right. You're continually changing the angle. Swamiji once said, I've told you all this before, I'm sure, but Swamiji said, teaching Vedanta is like an elephant dancing on a little post, a little stump.
Yeah.
Because the subject matter, you are just shifting the angle in this way and that way and this way and that way.
No, what I wanted to
say. Well, you know, there's Ganapati right there, and he's doing that very thing. He's just on that stump and dancing.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to say is that says, even in the recognition, because I kind of feel like that is really sinking in. I feel that anyway. Mm-hmm. That vision is definitely sinking in, slowly and steadily. And at the same time, I also feel there's a certain kind of quality of dukkha that arises as it's just like, as if you have been realizing I've walked through the swamp of my life, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't really know I was in the swamp. And now it's more like, the more the understanding unfolds, the more the vision unfolds that I'm looking down on myself being in the swamp. But I'm also in the swamp. And I didn't even recognize before how much I was in the swamp. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's a certain kind of, even though there's a liberation that takes place, there's also a certain kind of sadness that comes with that, you know, about when you look at the world and, you know, even from that perspective, there's a certain kind of even greater clarity of the dukkha that is just happening, or just the nature of my own desire, for example, right? If I desire now, I see it, okay, the desire arises and bah, I'm there, and I see it. And acting on that desire seems to be like a futile thing, right? Because you already know that's not going to go anywhere. So that road is already like a dead-end road in a certain way, because you don't believe in the concept anymore that will bring you happiness.
Yeah, but it's a little different than that. That's true. But when you don't, it's not so much of not believing in the concept. It's that you can enjoy your own ananda, your own wholeness, can engage fully in whatever you want to do, because you're not dependent on it for your wholeness, and so that gives you the freedom to really live, to really engage with others also, you know, and to really love others, because the love itself isn't totally dependent upon the other person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so you're actually, mm-hmm. there's a tremendous freedom in that.
I get the freedom. I mean, but it's good that you're pointing that out. But I'm also saying that it seems to be like an other side that kind of brings up a certain discomfort living. I don't know. I'm not quite 100% sure about the nature of the whole thing. I'm still exploring that.
Yeah.
But it's a kind of shifting into a whole new mode or something and feeling like, wow, you know, it's like, how am I just sustain this? Or how do I, you know, yeah, I don't know how to really.
Well, I think contemplation, that's why they say, you know, how long should I do shravana? Because Swamiji used jokes like this. Hmm. Student comes, how long do I really have to do shravana, Swamiji? Well, you do shravana, you know, You do shravana until you don't need to do shravana anymore. That's it. I mean, that's what it is, right? And our, like, say, initially, say you come to this teaching and all of a sudden you kind of realize that actually this is not going to give me the ananda. Mm-hmm. And then you start to look around, well, no, this isn't going to give me the ananda, you know? But as you're recognizing that, you're also recognizing the source of the ananda. And the reason, if this is, it's not that this isn't giving you ananda, it's that you are the ananda.
Right.
It has nothing to do with it giving it to you or not giving it to you. The problem is that you thought it did have something to do with that. So if you think the world has something to do with it, with your ananda, that is a problem, because actually it doesn't. And that's why you try to fulfill your desire and you fulfill the desire and it lasts for a few seconds and now you're back where you started. Why did I do all of that?
But it's a certain kind of futile dimension to being here or something. You know, even though there's another perspective that you pointed out, there's a freedom, I see that. But there's also futility to the whole Mahamaya that's just dancing around here. And that's,
not from Ishwara's standpoint.
Yeah, I guess I haven't really gotten to that totally, you know.
Yeah, because so. It's only, you think of futility when you think of that there's some grand scheme.
Uh-huh.
What is the grand scheme? I don't think it's like that, because if you look at the creation as beginningless,
uh-huh.
There's no first creation. It's a manifestation. It's the self. It's Ishwara. This is what is. And what is in it is the self itself is completely whole and full. Your being. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so when your being isn't being resisted because of your kind of externalization of yourself, then this is not a depressing experience. Love is not depressing, you know. Or existence, being is not depressing. It's complete. That's why when you meditate, if your mind is quiet and your mind is relaxed, you don't think, you don't go, oh, what a bummer. You know, you don't say, oh, this isn't worth anything. Because it's the opposite of that, you know? It's the opposite of it. Your very Swarupa. And so say your mind isn't resisting your own presence, then when your eyes are open or you're engaged, it's not futile. It has nothing, it's complete. See, wholeness doesn't depend upon time or upon accomplishment.
Mm-hmm.
It's the very nature of your being. Swamiji once said, you know, he has in Puranajadi near Mumbai. We had a little ashram there. He has a room that was a little smaller than this room. And he was just musing and he said, I could just stay here all my life. I could just sit here in this little room all my life and be fine. And it came in kind of a sweet moment, you know. Yeah, but because of your own nature, you know, your own nature is what you seek by running around and doing all these things. I mean, when you have knowledge, then you're running around and still running around and doing everything. That's your prarabdha, whatever the prarabdha is, and you're running around doing it.
So then, to look at life like it's some kind of challenge that I have to get to an end or get to a goal is completely opposite to it.
Well, there's no time in reference to yourself. And you are already completely present. And so the prarabdha itself, the story that we're living out, has its challenges, you know. But in terms of yourself, you are already here. And so it's not in the distance. It's something to be recognized through, gained through knowledge. So you can say, well, there's a lot of challenges to gaining that knowledge. Well, that's also true.
Well, but the desires are also woven into the prarabdha karma, right?
Yeah, That's true, but for a jnani that doesn't matter, because I can, you can have a desire out of happiness, not for happiness. You're already whole.
So
you can go after the desire. It gives you some energy. This is the next thing to do. The desire in the prarabdha pushes you, but you're not at stake.
Right, because you kind of disconnected from the attachment to the story, and you actually recognize who you really are.
That's right. So your ananda isn't at stake, and you can be fully engaged in the story. That's why the more you have knowledge, you watch your own objectivity growing, because you're free to deal with a situation that is there and to engage in it, but you don't feel threatened. Mm-hmm. So that feeling threatened has to do with the vairagya. You know, and the mind has to mature. All of us have to be patient and watch your mind. You know, Swamiji uses the example of like a little rose bud, and the little child wants to really see it as a flower. What does the rose look like when it, you know, when it opens up and then gets impatient? And then it's finally pulling it apart, and then we get this poor little crippled rosebud, you know.
Yeah, but you know,
you can enjoy that kind of the.
It was like when Arjuna got this cosmic vision, the cosmic eye, that he was so scared, so threatened.
He was scared because the ahankara was still there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You were mentioning earlier, it might have been in the context of meditation.
That's interesting.
Just getting your mind to relax. And it seems like that by itself leads to ananda.
It does.
But not to viveka, necessarily. Because if you don't have knowledge or, you know.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, if you can, like say you do yoga, or you take a walk in the park, or there's so many things you can do to make your mind relax, and the mind will then, as it relaxes, enjoy ananda. And not necessarily differentiate the ananda or your own being from the vritti. But with knowledge, that's not so. So like, for instance, when we, like say if I'm guiding, for instance, a meditation or something, I try to get the whole body and the mind just to be, to relax completely, you know. Instead of trying to concentrate, I just want it to relax. And then once it's relaxed and just letting the mind be as it is, then it becomes very useful to try to differentiate, you know, because the mind isn't resisting. We're worried about itself. It's just relaxed. Then you can start focusing on really your own presence and do a lot of viveka.
You might say, and this is kind of not a traditional analogy, but when your mind is relaxed, it's not preoccupied. Your RAM is not occupied with this whole Maya story that it's normally in.
Yeah.
So it's almost has more processing power to put to the
see
task
it.
Of, yeah.
That's good.
Making the distinction.
That's what was the simple. RAM?
The RAM in a computer RAM. It means the memory.
It's computer.
Yeah, it's computer lingo.
It's a breakthrough.
In the example of the... In the imagination or a dream, that the jiva who is a mumukshu and realizes the truth of the dream that you're having about himself. And when that happens, nothing. The dream still goes on. Like that realization in the dream doesn't actually change anything that's happening. Like nothing changes.
Yeah, exactly. In other words, when you gain knowledge, you're not going to drop dead or disappear or something like that,
yeah.
Right? But the thing is, when you gain knowledge, even though you stay in the dream, or we're talking about here in the waking state,
sure.
So you gain knowledge, everybody's still going to be there, you're still going to be living out your prarabdha, but you've recognized yourself as free, and the mind also, because of this, the freedom of yourself, and the mind isn't away from yourself, the mind is able to relax and enjoy the unfolding and engage in the unfolding of the prarabdha, all the while enjoying the freedom of your being. You know, so it's a very different internal experience. Once that, in terms of your life and the sukha dukkha, the pleasurable and painful events that life throws your way, but then you may not take them in terms of causing pleasure or pain, but they were meant to be painful. And that we say in the tradition, they just say, you know, life, the human life is 50-50. The prarabdha is 50-50. Half of it is nice, means pleasurable in some way or another, and the other half is hard. Yeah. I've often asked students as an exercise, it's kind of fun, you can write your life story, whatever you remember, divide your a page in half, and you can write one story of what a beautiful, incredible life you've had. And on the other side of the page, you can write this total nightmare. And both of them are intertwined, you know? And what can often happen is that people don't understand this, that they really have this intertwined sukha-dukkha life. Sometimes you'll see how blessed your life was, and sometimes you'll feel, you know, how torturous or how very difficult, what a difficult life I've had. And then you can say, oh, what a wonderful life. That's the sukha dukkha.
Sometimes even the bad things are turn out to be wonderful, right? Yeah. Because of all the suffering, you became a seeker of moksha, for example.
And you gained some depth and compassion.
And you gained some depth.
And, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, suffering.
Develop some viraga. Yeah.
It's powerful, huh?
Suffering often has a real positive side to it.
Just the ability to accept it
can
actually bring sukha.
It can, yeah. And freedom.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because there's a lot of freedom in the acceptance. But if you have knowledge, all of these things, the whole life is a sadhana, really, for the mind being able to have that freedom to just be with Ishwara, be with your prarabdha, and all the while enjoying the Atman, the Self.
So, say somebody that has this knowledge and they have a relationship, you know, for a lifetime, and then that person dies. What do you think the wise? I mean, that would be tragic in a way because there's a bond, and or does it just think that this is how change is? And
well, I think that there are human emotions, but the difference is the why me factor isn't there. There's the, I mean, say you lose, you know, a loved one, you know, or your pet. That's a loss, and it kind of deserves your grief. And grief, there's nothing wrong with grief. But for a jnani, it's more like riding on water. It's not a lot of baggage that you're carrying. It's a natural human sorrow that you can, it's just a natural human expression. But you're not carrying a lot of baggage, you're not resisting it, and you're not carrying a lot of baggage. So you're not building it like a castle around it.
So it's not a tragedy, or it's not a...
Well, it can even be a tragedy. You could say, this is such a tragedy.
Yeah.
But it's a tragedy within the scheme of things. And yourself isn't hurt by that tragedy. So when I say that, the self is never changes. And so your self, your being, really blesses and holds that tragic situation, or that painful situation.
It almost seems to me that your body and your mind are like this animal that you inhabit, and that you have to, it kind of has its own rules in a way. You have your psychology, and your body has the things that it needs.
Yeah.
And that is true, and you sort of have to
live with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and respectfully, you know. That's right, I agree with that. But if you think of it as riding on water instead of reacting to reactions, it's a totally different thing, because yourself, you know, holds. You know when I use this word inner friend? Mm-hmm. Your being is an inner friend without even words. Mm-hmm. And so all of the emotions of life take place in the environment of your being, because your mind isn't spinning around the things that happen. It's being with the things that happen and then objectively dealing with them. But if you know, knowledge isn't about making a person into kind of a cold person who has no emotional.
A stoic.
Yeah, it's not like walking around like a dead person or something. Or say you feel, oh, I'm not allowed, I'm a jnani, I don't have any feelings. It's not right.
But writing on water, I mean, like grief, just because it's writing on water doesn't necessarily mean grief will vanish like the writing. I mean, grief has a life of its own.
To a degree, but probably not as much for a jnani as for a jnani, because there's so much buildup on top of the emotion that's what keeps it really going.
Mm-hmm. The story.
The story and the why me and how could this happen and it's not fair. No.
And the Ravitvisha.
Cruel life is. How cruel life is to happen. Yeah. I never should have fallen in love.
Yeah, you idiot.
Yeah.